Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Pallast, who assesses the Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case and the repercussions for U.S. elections and democracy. Jenna Vitar, a New York City high school student who participated in the Gaza Freedom March, talks about how she gained the courage to defy the Egyptian authorities to fight for justice for Palestinians. And Dr. Rachel Narden, Chief of Neurology at Cambridge Health Alliance and Chapter President of Physicians for a National Health Program, who discusses the message voters sent on health care in Massachusetts' recent special Senate election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Ukraine's 2004 pro-Western Orange Revolution appears in peril as opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych, who lost the confrontational 2004 election to pro-democracy forces, easily finished first in the preliminary round of the presidential election on January 17th, despite the fact that he was charged with rigging the 2004 election. Yanukovych, who has close ties to the Kremlin, won 38% of the vote and will face off against populist Prime Minister Julia Tymoshenko in a February 7th presidential runoff. Incumbent President Viktor Yushchenko, another leader of the Orange Revolution, finished fifth. His attempts to bring Russia into a Western style of democracy and economy seem to have failed. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Ukraine also faced the end of Russian energy subsidies, and Yushchenko fared poorly in several confrontations over natural gas supplies with Moscow, known as the Gas Wars. Although they have been feuding for years, Yanukovych and Ms. Tymoshenko do not currently advocate that Ukraine join NATO, and both have indicated a desire to smooth relations with Russia while continuing to court Europe. The Washington Post reports that between 2002 and 2006, the FBI illegally collected over 2,000 telephone call records by invoking terrorism crises that did not exist or by merely persuading phone companies to provide records. In 2003, the head of the FBI's counterterrorism office, Larry Mefford, issued a bureau-wide communique that authorized using a device called an exigent circumstances letter that allows a supervisor to declare an emergency, get the records, and then issue a national security letter after the fact. Soon afterwards, phone companies started to make complaints to the FBI, saying they had not received documents showing that these searches would be legal. In 2005, an internal request in the FBI was made to get national security letters for phone searches. By 2006, the FBI developed a blanket national security letter to authorize all past phone searches. A November 2006 email exchange revealed that then-Assistant Director for Counterterrorism Joseph Billy signed the blanket national security letter, but he wrote to FBI lawyers who raised concerns about it that he could not remember signing it. According to interviews with government officials, among those whose phone records were searched improperly were journalists from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Scott Roeder, the man charged with killing Kansas doctor George Tiller, had apparently stalked his victim for months and recently bought a new gun before shooting the medical director and provider of late-term abortions during a church service last May at the Reformation Lutheran Church in Wichita. The Los Angeles Times reports that church usher Gary Heppner testified he was standing in the church's foyer with Dr. Tiller at 10 a.m. when services were just beginning. Roeder came out of the sanctuary and, "I looked up," said Heppner, "and this guy put a gun to George's head and shot him point blank." Roeder is now on trial for first-degree premeditated murder and faces a sentence of life in prison. He also faces two counts of aggravated assault for allegedly threatening the two men with a gun as they followed him out of the church. The trial began on the 37th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortion. Roeder admitted in interviews in court documents that he killed Dr. Tiller, but has now pled not guilty to the charges, saying he killed the doctor to save the lives of the unborn. Also in attendance were several anti-abortion activists, including Regina Dinwiddie of Kansas City, Kansas, who put up items for sale on eBay, including artwork that Roeder made while in prison, in an attempt to raise money for Roeder's defense. However, the online auction house has pulled the items. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a precedent-shattering ruling on January 21st, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned seven previous decisions by removing all limits on corporate spending and political campaigns. In the 5-4 decision in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the majority removed restrictions on campaign expenditures for corporations, labor unions, and nonprofit groups, declaring these limits violated the First Amendment's free speech principles. In his dissenting opinion, Justice John Paul Stevens was scathing in his criticism of the court's majority when he said, "The rule announced today that Congress must treat corporations exactly like human speakers in the political realm represents a radical change in the law. The court's decision is at war with the views of generations of Americans." In response to the ruling, President Obama vowed to pass legislation that would require shareholders to vote before a corporation could spend money in elections, require companies that pay for candidate advertising to identify themselves, and restrict corporations with big government contracts from buying campaign ads. Other groups are promoting remedies such as public financing for federal candidates and an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast, who looks at the court decision and the billions of dollars that will likely now be pumped into U.S. election campaigns from American and foreign corporations as well as overseas governments.
There was a corporation which put up money to run an attack piece, a smear on Hillary Clinton, called Hillary the Movie. Well, corporations are allowed to do that, actually, as long as they're not actually supporting a candidate. They can smear a candidate, but they can't support one, and they can't do it within 30 days of an election. That's the current rule. This group was really, in the first place, simply asking to bust the 30-day rule on so-called independent spending. You know, we can smear, but we can't support. The justices said, hey, man, we'll not only give you that, we're not only give you the pig snout, we're going to take it all the way back to the pigs behind and the squeal. The court, the charge being led by Chief Justice Roberts, said no restrictions on corporations, including campaign giving, nothing like that. We're going to go way beyond this case. Not only remove the 30-day limit, you're going to be able to have corporations donate to campaigns, no limitations, go have fun, open the checkbooks. And that's what this decision ended up doing, 5-4, very bitter, to the point where you know, Stevens, who's a pretty calm guy, was saying, this basically defames the entire court. No one's going to believe the court anymore, as if they did after Bush v. Gore anyway.
As you point out in your article, individual citizens in the United States are limited to $2,300 to give to a presidential candidate in a given year. That doesn't change. So corporations can literally, they can send a $1 trillion check to any candidate they like, but citizens are still limited to this $2,300 limit. Is that right?
That's the interpretation I've gotten from the constitutional lawyers I've spoken to of this decision. It looks like this, like, really the sky's the limit. And the other thing is, you know, if they say, okay, if a corporation has a $2,300 limit on, say, a presidential campaign, you can have 92 corporations. You have hedge funds which have 200 corporations for every little investment vehicle they have. They can, you know, you can have gazillions of corporations, all for the purpose of making campaign donations. I mean, I have to tell you, there's been a big distraction in this discussion. I've heard congressmen and public citizen and others complain, oh, my God, Exxon and Bank of America, and Obama said this, Wall Street banks are going to put tremendous amount of money into political campaigns. They already have. I'm not worried, frankly, about Bank of America and Exxon and the others, because they're already loading the system. But they load it under certain rules. Mainly, they can't be secret. Bank of America, as a corporation, can't give any money. And yet they're listed as a major donor to Barack Obama's campaign. The reason is that people who work with Bank of America bundle up their checks, but you can look at every name of the giver behind Bank of America and see that they're who they are, what they do at Bank of America, what their job is, and how much they gave, and that they are United States citizens. Under the new rule, forget about it. UBS, United Bank of Switzerland, was just fined nearly $750 million for cheating the U.S. Treasury, helping tax cheats. So we fined them, our government fined this Swiss bank $750 million for monkey business. Well, now how is it worth it for the Swiss to take, instead of $750 million fine, take $250 million, and buy themselves 5 or 6 U.S. senators? You know, it's cheaper. So it's cheaper for them to buy the system than to accept the fines, and then the sky's the limit. The People's Liberation Army of China, they supply clothing to Walmart through a label called New Order, believe it or not. The Chinese Army is called New Order label clothes. Well, I assume that they have an incorporation in the U.S. If not, they can get one. Hey, it's worth it to them to put $2 billion in the campaign. You know, they said billion. We're now going to be looking at billion-dollar donations. That's a guaranteed lockup. And not from Exxon, but from foreign sources.
Well, Greg, just a final question. Is there any silver lining to the Supreme Court decision in that it could serve as a wake-up call for citizens of this country to know with certainty that democracy has been for a long time an endangered species, and with this ruling, it will almost certainly die without some changes? Could we limit the activities of corporations by issuing new types of corporate charters that government issues?
Yeah,
is there anything that we can do to really alter how this thing's going to play out?
Right. There is a lot that can be done. I was disappointed when Public Citizen said that the only thing that could be done was a constitutional amendment. Nuh-uh. Even Roberts said himself, you could restrict corporations from using foreign money. One would be that every corporation has to certify that it has no foreign owners before they can donate, or they have to reveal their stockholders list. They won't want to do that. Divulge who your stockholders are. If there's any foreign stockholders, we want to know who they are. Who are you? And the one thing that corporations aren't going to do is say who they really are, and especially some of these so-called not-for-profits that are going to be putting money into campaigns, which is a bit crazy. As a natural, flesh-and-blood, real citizen, you have to say who you are when you donate. So why not require corporations to, in fact, adhere to the same rules that real human beings adhere to? Now, if Congress did that, that would actually virtually stop this game at the front end. But, you know, you'll be surprised. All these teabaggers and flag wavers who say, yeah, America's first, if you say, well, don't you believe that we should say only American corporations, only American-owned corporations should be allowed to put money in our campaigns, you won't hear a word from them. Believe me, you won't hear a word from them.
That was Greg Palast, BBC TV investigative reporter and author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Read his article, Manchurian Candidates, Supreme Court Allows China and Others Unlimited Spending in U.S. Elections, online at gregpalast.com. On January 21st, activists in New York City organized an event where they heard a report back from participants in the Gaza Freedom March. New Yorkers were among the more than 1,300 participants from 43 countries who met in Cairo in preparation for a December 31st march to Gaza in solidarity with Palestinians inside the territory that had been invaded by Israel exactly 1 year before. At first, the Egyptian government refused to allow any of the activists into Gaza through the Egyptian-controlled border. But finally, the government agreed to permit 100 people to deliver humanitarian supplies, but this generated a great deal of controversy, and ultimately less than 100 took buses into Gaza while the rest of the marchers stayed in Cairo and carried out street protests to draw attention to the collusion of Egypt, Israel, and the United States in the oppression and economic blockade of Palestinians living in Gaza. One of the youngest participants in the Freedom March was Jenna Bitar, a senior at Hunter High School in Manhattan. She was one of four speakers at the New York event and began by identifying herself as half Palestinian, but noted that no one in her family had been politically active around the issue until the Israeli invasion of Gaza. After hearing about the December march, she and her mother and older brother all decided to go. In the following excerpt of her remarks, Bitar explains what a training ground the trip was for her as a young activist, and how she gained the courage to defy the Egyptian authorities through solidarity with others who shared the same vision of justice for Palestinians.
We landed in Cairo, and we had known that the Egyptian government had said officially for the first time, they made an announcement that the Gaza Freedom March is not getting into Gaza. But in my mind, this meant that we were going to drive to the border, and they were going to say no, and we were going to protest outside of the border, and put enough pressure on 1,400 of us, put enough pressure on them to let us in. I really naively hadn't thought about getting stuck in Cairo. At that point, I made the realization that we had a political goal. We weren't there. We wanted to be with the Gazan people, and we wanted to stand with them. But we were really there for political reasons, and that was to bring attention to the siege on Gaza. And being in Cairo, what we had was our power in numbers, and not just representation of one country, but I think it was 43 different countries that we represented. They had told us that it was illegal to meet in groups larger than six. So we were in these like illegal, what felt like underground meetings where we would meet and brainstorm with some activists that have been doing this for so long and have been involved in so much, you know, other huge movements that you got to share ideas and hear about their experiences. You know, it helped a lot with the courage going into this. We were going to be demonstrating, and it was going to be scary, which it was. But there was a lot of preparation and talking, and that just helped a lot in terms of being young and being there. It wasn't the student delegation as much that was really powerful. It was the fact that we were able to see clearly how a movement works and be part of it. So, as I mentioned, with learning experiences, I wanted to share a few examples of where I got to personally push the limits of the Egyptian government. I don't know if that's something to be proud of. I was with my good friend Manije Saba, and she was doing the hunger strike. It was a few days into the hunger strike. There were 30 activists on the hunger strike, and they were going to do a press release in front of the Journal Syndicate, and her and I left early from the hotel. And we were walking over, and we get there, and the police are dispersing everyone. People had met kind of there before. Police are dispersing everybody. And she grabbed my arm, pushed through all the police, and she said, "Listen, Jenna, we're taking this space." So we sat down on the stairs, and I was terrified because the police are really intimidating. We sat down on the stairs, and she said, "Don't move." And so they're coming over to us, and they're yelling at us and screaming at us. And she just, like, looks past me, and she's like, "Everybody, come sit down. Soon enough, we have this whole group of people sitting there, and the cops just completely backed off. And she, you know, nudged me and said, "This is how you do it. You want the space, you take it." And this is just a note on the solidarity of the marchers themselves. You know, all these people sharing one passion, just what it looked like. We are all linked arms. And we were standing together with a bunch of women, and they were just dragging people out. They're trying to get us onto the street, onto the sidewalk, because we're on the street. And they're just dragging everyone and pulling everyone and hitting everyone. I kind of made my way. I tried to avoid the beating as much as possible. But I was able, you know, I was seeing they were just pulling women's hair, and they were just hitting everyone, kicking this woman on the ground. And I got up on the sidewalk, and I just started sobbing. Because it was awful. And then I remember a man, I'd never spoken to him before or after that. I think he's from the Italian delegation. He just took me and held me. And, you know, it was that type of unity that was, it was something I'd never expect to experience as a high schooler. And it was beautiful, and it, you know, empowered me. I feel great to be here and enthusiastic about being part of what I think is really a movement on the rise. Just that we were all there together with one passion, and that was to free Gaza. So, thank you.
That was Jenna Vitar, who participated in the Gaza Freedom March in late December, speaking at an event in New York City. For more information, visit the GazaFreedomMarch.org website. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. In a stunning upset on January 19th, Massachusetts voters elected a little-known Republican state senator, Scott Brown, to fill the vacant seat of the late U.S. Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Brown's defeat of Democratic candidate Martha Coakley, who serves as Massachusetts Attorney General by a 52-47% margin, drove party activists and reporters to look for answers for how this could have happened in the overwhelmingly Democratic state. Brown campaigned as the potential 41st vote to stop President Obama and Congress from passing national health care reform legislation, depriving the Democrats of the 60 votes needed to overcome a GOP filibuster. Brown's position during this campaign was at odds with his vote in favor of a 2006 Massachusetts health care system overhaul, signed into law by former Republican Governor Mitt Romney, that has many of the same mandates and subsidies as the bills now being proposed in Washington. Exit polling of voters found that 52% surveyed said they opposed the federal health care reform measure, and 42% said they cast their ballot to help stop President Obama from passing his chief domestic initiative. Despite strong feelings about national health care reform, 68% of people who voted in the January 19th special election said they supported Massachusetts' own health reform system. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Rachel Narden, Chief, Division of Neurology, Cambridge Health Alliance, and Massachusetts Chapter President of Physicians for a National Health Plan, a group that advocates for a single-payer universal health care system. Dr. Narden examines what message, if any, Massachusetts voters were sending on public health care policy in the special U.S. Senate election.
Well, I think it's clear that voters didn't like the health care reform that Congress was considering. And, you know, it's always hard not to put one's own personal slant on things, but it was a bad bill. You know, it didn't control costs, and it wasn't going to do a lot to get rid of the big copays and deductibles that are making health care unaffordable even for insured Americans these days. And, you know, I think that the vote was, it was probably a lot of things, but I think in part it was some anger at a health care bill that seemed to be more of giving away stuff to the special interests, in this case the private insurance companies and the drug and device makers, and not really ensuring that regular Americans got what they need, which in the case of health care is the care they need when they need it at a price they can afford.
So there are many Republicans, conservative commentators who talk about the message of Massachusetts voters as saying they don't want any health care reform and they just like things the way they are. Of course, in your state, there's the extra added dimension of the fact that back in March of 2006, there was a statewide health care reform plan put in place. How much do you think people's satisfaction or dissatisfaction with the Massachusetts plan played into how they viewed the proposals for national health reform, which in large measure are based on the Massachusetts plan?
Well, I think it's got to have something to do with it. I mean, Massachusetts health care reform was basically a living laboratory for the national health care reform that was proposed. It really had all the essential elements that were being considered nationally. It had an individual mandate. It had expansion of Medicaid. It had subsidized private insurance for low-income people. And it did not have cost control. And without cost control, health care costs continue to rise. And we've seen that in the state to the point where it's bankrupting the state and bankrupting municipal governments. And people also haven't seen their premiums go down. And they've seen, because costs keep rising and insurers need to do something about that to keep premiums down, they end up shifting the cost to people. So people have seen their copays and deductibles go up. So I think it doesn't feel like a real success to many people in Massachusetts. And, you know, I think there was some reasonable skepticism that if we do this on a national level, we'd be any better off. And I really do disagree with the Republican spin that the Massachusetts vote meant that people don't want any health care reform. I think if you look at a lot of other polls, people are still dissatisfied with our health care system. They know something has to be done. So it isn't like that suddenly went away. I think it's really more fair to say that this is a referendum on the health care reform that's being considered, which is really a giant giveaway to the private insurance industry without any real cost control measures or any attempt to protect ordinary Americans from the financial burden of getting sick that they're currently struggling under.
Dr. Narden, what would you like to see happen now in the U.S. Congress? A lot of politicians are running scared about the Massachusetts special election result and think they have to pull back, really trim the sails of whatever kinds of reform can pass without the filibuster-proof 60 votes that they needed in the Senate. What do you hope the Congress does now?
Congress goes back to the drawing board. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, this bill was a giant giveaway to the private insurance industry. It wasn't going to cover everybody. It was going to cost an enormous amount of money. Congress knows, the president knows, he's said on several occasions, he knows that there's already a plan out there that will cover everybody for a cost we can afford. It's fiscally responsible. It's already in place. It could be implemented within a year. You know, Medicare was implemented within a year of its passage in 1965. Congress knows that there's a plan that'll work, and I hope that the lesson that the country doesn't like this giveaway to the private insurance industry and a plan that isn't going to cover everybody and isn't going to be affordable isn't going to fly. But I hope that they know that they can't give up on health care reform, because this really is an enormous drag on people's personal finances, on the ability of our businesses to compete. We've got to do something about this, and I hope that they'll use this as a wake-up call to go back to the drawing board and pass a reform that we know will work.
Are you concerned that this election result in Massachusetts could really have people run totally in the other direction and we'd lose a chance here to make any progress?
Well, they may run temporarily in the other direction, but this is a problem that's not going to go away. I mean, health care costs are spiraling absolutely out of control. You know, we're on target for them to be, you know, they're already 16% of gross domestic product. They're just huge. You know, the average premium for a family plan is heading toward $15,000 a year. You know, this compares very unfavorably with the median family income, you know, which is somewhere around $50,000 a year. So it just, this is not a sustainable situation. So we've got to do something, and we've got to do something that works. And, you know, even if we retreat now and do some tiny temporizing measures, we're not going to be able to escape looking this problem in the face again pretty soon. And, you know, my job as somebody who believes there's a real solution out there that could solve our problems is to keep putting that in front of legislators until the magnitude of the problem is so large that they realize they've got to actually turn to a solution that's really going to work.
That was Dr. Rachel Narden, Chief of Neurology, Cambridge Health Alliance, and Massachusetts Chapter President of Physicians for a National Health Plan. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at pnhp.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446. Or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Topp. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.